In early November, a drafting committee of the Conference of Bishops of the Roman Catholic Church released a statement, a lengthy statement, which they've been asked to write by their parent body, dealing with Catholic social teaching and the United States economy. This draft had been some 4 years in the preparation. It will now be circulated by the bishops to various people in their diocese, and then they will assemble again at another meeting next year, and with whatever changes or emendations they may decide to make, this so-called pastoral letter will become an official statement of the American Roman Catholic Church, and it will form the basis of teachings on social ideas by the church in their parochial schools and from the pulpit. Now, a document of this kind is obviously looked at in many different ways. There were some who read through the initial document and chose to highlight for praise or for blame some specific proposal which was made. The document, for instance, calls for a major employment program, which would involve reducing the level of unemployment to almost nothing, 3.5%, to accomplish this by a federal works program, by major financing of jobs retraining programs, and by a program of federal subsidies given to individual employers, which would allow them to add more people to their labor roles. There was also a rather broadside criticism, typified by a group of Roman Catholic laymen, well known for the most part, led by the former Secretary of the Treasury, Mr. William Simon, and by the Catholic lay theologian, Novak. And these men claimed that this entire document was far too critical of the American economic system, that it was, the proposals that it put forward were what it called statist, that they involved a great deal of government intervention. And therefore, they felt that they were likely, these proposals, to kill the goose that laid the golden egg, that to so limit and restrict and constrict the economy that the prosperity of the economy would be diminished and there would be less for more rather than more for those who most need it. Now, when the leadership of a church which is as important as the Roman Catholic Church and is structured comes forth with a document of this type, they do not do so idly. It's a matter of forethought, judgment, and the document must be taken seriously. Not because some 40 million Catholics will inevitably agree with and promote all of the proposals which are submitted. The bishops know very well that that's most unlikely, but rather because the Roman Catholic Church is an important political and social institution, and that this document makes clear those proposals and those positions which its lobbyists will take with the Congress and with the various state legislatures, and which its pulpits and teachers will take with the community, its community itself. So we're likely to see a good deal of push towards those proposals which are central to this document. For instance, the document insists that the West and the advanced nations, particularly the United States, must dramatically increase its level of foreign aid, particularly development aid, to the third world nations. And that it should do so not bilaterally, but multilaterally by using agencies such as the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, or the agencies of the United Nations. And we're likely to see a great push in this direction from the Catholic Church. Now, the draft was prepared and ready for submission earlier than November. It was not submitted until after the elections because they wanted this document to be considered as on its own merit and not as a partisan or party document. And the bishops were quite aware that more of the proposals which they submit tie in with the general direction of the Democratic Party platform than that of the Republican platform. Indeed, I think they're quite conscious of the fact that in this last election, a majority of Roman Catholics voted for President Reagan, and that simply suggests to them, I would think, the degree of the magnitude of the task which lies before them. Now, everyone will read this document. It runs to well over 100 pages in their own way. The press has tended to emphasize the practical proposals. The document is divided into two major sections. The first deals with biblical and theological foundations, and the second with practical implications. And so the press has seized on the demands for welfare reform, the demands for a national level of welfare payments much higher than that which is in place in most of the states now. They emphasize the need for child care support and child care centers, daycare centers. They emphasize the importance of employer-employee councils and employer and employee ownership in the business enterprise. They emphasize the importance of allowing those who receive aid from the federal government to determine to a very large degree how this aid shall be distributed and used at a local level. My own interest was piqued by the first section, that which had to do with the biblical and theological foundations. As a rabbi, obviously, it's a world which I know and it interests me. And having read a great deal of the Roman Catholic pronouncement of the earlier times, one cannot but be struck with the radical transvaluation of values which has taken place in the last 100 years within the Roman Catholic Church. The Roman Catholic Church used to emphasize the fact that this world was what they called a via dolorosa, a way, a valley of tears, whose pains and anguish and burden had to be borne with grace and with faith. Indeed, they tended to look upon poverty as almost a gift from God. Jesus once said, "The rich have already received their consolation." And Paul and others took this to mean that the poor have a chance because of their trials and their pains to prove their faith, to prove their steadiness, and because of that proof, they will more quickly enter the bliss eternal, the glories and joys of heaven. The traditional church had an eschatological vision of the future. That is, the future would become better when God willed it to become better, when the second coming of the Christ would take place. God alone could, in any significant way, transform the world. Man, by his own actions, could only submit, accept, and have faith. Now, this doctrine, this document, is activist. It is utopian in the sense that it has a vision of man achieving through his own efforts, humanity achieving through their own efforts, a better world. It is positive and optimistic in its outlook. And it looks upon the eradication of poverty as the goal, not some patient submission to the woes and anguish of the world. Indeed, one is struck as one reads through this document that if a college of cardinals in the Middle Ages had read it, they would probably accuse its authors of a Judaizing heresy, because there is far more of Moses and far more of Amos in this document than of Paul or of Augustine. The church has come a long way. And what the document does is to establish the foundations for its social thought on the basis of three biblical categories of thought: community, covenant, and community, covenant, and creation. The early church almost looked upon community as an impediment to the religious life. The emphasis was on withdrawal. The emphasis was on communion with God rather than commitment and community with one's fellow man. But listen to this document. Human life is fulfilled in communion with others. To be human is to respond to the call of the community. We can find true completion only through the sublime gift of ourselves to those with whom we share the gift of life. I'm reminded of the rabbinic statement, you know, do not separate yourself from the community. Al tifrosh min hatzibur. And though obviously the church has not given up in other aspects, monasticism, withdrawal, the emphasis on the personal religious life, the emphasis here is on society and community, on participation and on activity, on the very values that I read of Isaiah, which I read to you this morning. God does not really demand vain oblations. These are rituals, are means to an end. The end is to cease to do evil, to learn to do good. And that's to do it within the context of the community. So the church has abandoned, at least for an American church, it's this emphasis on a withdrawal, on the life which is not of this world. It's a very worldly document. It's a document which forward to major changes within the social order. And following on from this emphasis on community, which is very biblical, obviously, it comes to a new appreciation of the covenant of Sinai. Medieval church tended to look upon the Decalogue, upon the Ten Commandments, as essentially a covenant of faith. What was important was, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. I am the Lord. The specific instructions of the Torah, the specific rules and regulations were looked upon in a rather denigrating way. Paul said that the law is a curse, that the law and the whole commingling of man with society, which requires law and structure, pulls man away from that which is consequential and central, the religious life, his need to gain immortality. And so the church downplayed and denigrated the specific instructions. Listen to this document. Far from being an arbitrary restriction on the life of the people, these codes, the Decalogue, the Book of the Covenant, and Exodus, made life and community possible. The specific laws of the covenant protect human life, they protect human property, they demand respect for parents and spouses and children of one's neighbor. Social interaction is to reflect the norms of covenant, reciprocal responsibility, mercy, and truthfulness. Living like this brings wholeness, shalom. The laws manifest a special concern for the vulnerable members of the community, widows, orphans, the poor, and strangers in the land. The codes of Israel embody a life freed from slavery, worship of the one God, rejection of idolatry, mutual respect among people, care and protection for every member of the social body. Being free and being a co-responsible community are God's intent for us, according to the Bible. Individuals are responsible before God, both to and for the community. Now, I couldn't say that any better. And there's nothing there that I haven't tried to say to you time and time again. Having come to accept the social context of life, the importance of law, and how the early church damned the law, God was a God of love, and one was through the Spirit that one fulfilled oneself, not through the shackles of Torah, of God's instructions. The church now comes to an understanding of creation. This is a good earth, not a veil of tears. I quote Genesis 1, Vayar ki tov, and God saw what he had done, and it was good. Tov meod, it was very good. God created good, and God created man in his own image, which this document takes to mean that man is to be, as God is, a creator, or rather a steward of all that God has given him, and in that sense a creator of prosperity and of wholeness for the world by protecting, by replenishing, by caring for, by being the proper steward of this gift of the good earth. This document is obviously environmentalist. But more than this, it sees for man an active role as what the rabbis called a shutaf v'maaseh bereshit, a partner with God in the work of creation. And it sees the possibility of creation not only in the building of a better life here and now, but ultimately in new creation, the creating of a life which will be better for all. Creation is the gift of God to all. Man ought not to stop at national boundaries or boundaries of class or boundaries of hemisphere in his concern for human welfare and human well-being. We must be concerned with all, for all are God's creatures. And this leads in the document to an eschatology that is a vision of the future, which is no longer largely supernatural. That is, that God will in the end of days send down the Christ and there will be a miraculous and marvelous recreation of the world, but rather what we would call a messianic vision of the future, one in which man, working with God, will achieve a gracious society. The vision of creation, covenant, community unfolds within the context of biblical eschatology, the context of our ultimate hope for humanity and for the whole world. The whole Bible is spanned by the narratives of the first creation and the vision of a restored creation at the end of history. Just as creation tells us that God's original design for the world was one of wholeness and unity between God and the human family and within the human family itself, eschatological imagery offers visions of a restored and renewed creation, a new heaven and a new earth. Enmity and hatred will cease, and justice and peace will reign. I might well have, you know, quoted, they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Now, all this is, of course, very biblical and very Jewish. And interestingly, the document goes on to emphasize that which is the classic biblical virtue, that of tzedakah, that of justice. The early and medieval church emphasized caritas, charity. It emphasized agape, selfless love. But the idea of mishpat and tzedakah, of the necessary structuring of the social order to ensure the well-being of all, this was an idea which is largely absent from the teachings and the preachings of the earlier church. They looked upon the need for man to be open to the needs of others in the sense of charity, of giving, but not in the sense of changing the social order so that order will reflect and provide and it permit of decency and dignity to all. But now, listen to this paragraph on the primacy of justice. Characteristic of biblical faith is the insistence that reverence for God as creator and fidelity to the covenant are expressed by an equal reverence and concern for the neighbor. The biblical terms which best summarize this double dimension of biblical faith are tzedakah, justice, and mishpat, right judgment or justice embodied in a concrete act or deed. The biblical understanding of justice also gives a fundamental perspective to our reflections on social justice and economic issues. In the Bible, God is described as a God of justice, who loves justice and delights in it. God executes justice for the needy and demands justice for the whole people. Justice and only justice you shall follow, that you may live and inherit the land which the Lord your God gives you. The covenant between God and the people is a betrothal in righteousness and in justice, in steadfast love and in mercy. Justice has many levels of meaning. Fundamentally, it suggests a sense of what is right and should happen. For example, paths are just when they bring you to your destination, and laws are just when they create harmony within the community. People are summoned to be just, that is, to be in a proper relation to God by observing God's laws which form them into a faithful community. When a society is just, prosperity and blessing result. As Isaiah says, justice will bring peace, right will produce calm and security. Again, a rabbi could not have said it any more effectively. And what they are saying is revolutionary for the church, although it has been the direction which the church has been moving for the last 100 years. It emphasizes the church's impatience with the structured class order of society with which it made its peace in the Middle Ages. It emphasizes the church's having moved beyond that level of social thought, which emphasized giving of something of one's wealth to those who are less fortunate, but allowing them to be allowing the powerful essentially to be indifferent to the restructuring of the society in a more democratic and free and just way, because that would have upset the social order, the authoritarian social order with which the church until quite recently time easily and willingly made its peace. And so we have, flowing out of this emphasis on justice, a whole series of comments and practical implications which have to do with welfare reform, which have to do with increased aid to the underdeveloped nations, which have to do with the elimination of all of the limitations which exist in our society due to gender or to race or to other forms of arbitrary forms of exclusion, an emphasis on adequate education for the modern world, an emphasis on decency in the development of a welfare program, an emphasis on a negative income tax, an emphasis on a whole variety of issues which would in one way or another help to establish within the structures of the social order itself a greater sense of justice for all. But then the document goes on in a way which shows that these bishops have continued to take from the Torah what they want to take from it, but have not yet taken from it its full implication. They define justice in a very special way. 2 years ago, when the present Pope was in Mexico City for a famous meeting with the more radical priests of Latin America, he tried to diffuse what tends to be called in the church liberation theology, which is the need of the church to identify itself fully with all the revolutionary movements of the third world, whatever be the full implications of those movements, by espousing a doctrine which he called the preferential option for the poor. The preferential option for the poor creates a standard of justice by which justice is judged almost entirely by its consequences for the poor. If an act benefits the poor, it is just. If it fails directly to benefit the poor, it is unjust. And obviously, in a highly structured world such as that of Latin America, where the divisions between the few of privilege and the few of power and the mass who are impoverished and oppressed, this kind of simple rule has some degree of application. But as a standard for justice itself, in a theoretical sense, I believe it to be an inadequate one. It comes from a fundamental attitude towards the poor, which is special to the church and is rather alien to our own tradition. The church tends to, at least in its sermonics, to downgrade the rich. It tends to emphasize all of the vices which occur to people of comfort, of affluence or of power, the tendency towards arrogance, towards self-righteousness, towards callousness, towards insensitivity to the plight and the needs of others, all vices which we readily recognize in ourselves and in our world. But then it goes on and does not recognize similar limitations among those fallible human beings who, by some unfortunate concatenation of events, happen to be poor. Indeed, blessed are the poor. Indeed, the poor are looked upon are those who are particularly receptive to the message of the church. Now, in our tradition, justice is defined in a broader way. There is a wonderful section in the book of Leviticus which is called the Holiness Code. We read it on Yom Kippur. It begins, "Holy shall you be, for I, the Lord your God, am holy." It's a section in which we're told we must protect the stranger and the alien who is within our midst, in which we must not keep the garment of a poor man overnight, because we must not withhold the wages which are due to him. It's a section which includes that wonderful phrase, "You shall love your neighbor as yourself," and have that same self of social obligation to him that you have to yourself. But it also contains a fascinating sentence which the bishops have really not weighed and contemplated. Lo tisa pnei dal, you shall not defer to the poor. Lo tedar pnei gadol, you shall not defer to the rich. Et tzedek tishpot amitecha, with justice shall you judge your people. The well-being of the whole is the ultimate standard of justice. not the well-being of any one part of the whole. If the heart doesn't pump, none of the limbs can be healthy or alive or carry out their function. After the defeat of the Bar Kokhba rebellion in the year 135 of this era, a rebellion which, for all the nobility which is enshrined in Matsada, was a terrible, terrible blunder, a terrible, costly bloodletting. Over a million Judeans lost their lives. The country was decimated. The Romans exacted ferocious punishment. A group of the sages met at a place called Usha, and they passed a number of decisions, one of which is relevant. The decision is this. It's rather startling when you first come across it. No man is to give more than 20% of his total wealth to others during any one year. Now, what were they saying? They were saying that in this ocean of poverty, of misery, where death was rampant, people had been driven off their land, destitution was the order of the day, there were still some few pockets of people who had somehow escaped the devastation. There always are after any disaster. And if these people, moved by empathy, by sympathy, by charity, by justice, had given everything of their own to all those who came by, they themselves would simply be part of the larger ocean of the impoverished and the destitute. And it was far better in the long run for the society to have a few farms where the farmer could buy grain to sow his field to have a crop for the next year. It was far better to have a few artisans who could afford to go out and buy equipment to replace the equipment which the Romans had broken and begin again to develop something called a town or an urban economy. And what the rabbis were essentially saying by this kind of surprising restriction was exactly what the book of Leviticus warns us against. That is, making our understandable empathy and sympathy for the poor the sole yardstick of justice. Now, God knows we ought to be doing everything we can for the famine-stricken, impoverished people of Sub-Sahara and Ethiopian Africa. But is that ultimately the solution for their problems? You know, 10 years ago, this man, Mengetsu Haile Mariam, the head of the Durga, the junta, the military junta which rules Ethiopia, overthrew Haile Selassie, another autocrat, and he came into power promising to change the social structure of the community for the benefit of all. But he quickly imposed a military dictatorship on the country, and the policies which have been followed were as reactionary and restrictive as those which had been in place before. And he was warned as early as 1981 by a group of Oxford scientists who were asked to come out by some world group to Ethiopia. He was warned about the danger of famine. And he was told that three things needed to be done. The government had to speed up its work on irrigation. The government had to divert monies that it was spending on armaments to social projects, development projects, and the government had to stop paying heavy subsidies to urban dwellers so that the food would be cheap to them because the farmers had no longer any reason to produce food for anything beyond subsistence. And Mengistu paid no attention to any of these undertakings. In fact, he increased the level of the expenditures of his government to nearly 50% for arms that he bought from the Soviet Union. He made no attempt to decrease the subsidies for food so that the farmers would have incentives to produce. As recently as last September, he spent $200 million for a great bash to celebrate the 10th anniversary of his accession to power. And food and liquor and all of that was there heavy on the tables. Indifference, lack of concern, clearly simply giving without some kind of response. It's clearly an ethic which is concerned only with what the document calls the obscene differential between what we have and what the poor of the world do not have. Clearly, such a standard of judgment is more a standard of concern than it is one of judgment. It is obscene. It is obscene that we have so much and they have so little. But divesting ourselves of everything will not by itself bring them up to any level of decency and will destroy whatever prosperity this economy may have. And so it is that this emphasis on the and glorification of the poor, this tendency to focus on what is good for the poor as the sole standard of justice, is in my mind one which has very definite limits to it and is quite inadequate. Now, that in no way should be a justification for the kind of indifference to the development needs of the third world, which has tended to typify our government in recent years. Quite to the contrary, we are not the most generous government in the world in terms of foreign economic aid. And we very often tie our aid to political considerations that have nothing to do with anything but our Cold War with the Soviet Union. But clearly, that kind of compassion which the church is associated with, which we instinctively feel, is not in and of itself a sufficient standard of judgment to create a document which would have to do with what justice consists of in the modern world. What we need, both here and abroad, is a slow development of economies which can sustain prosperity, and the development of structures within those economies which guarantee both economic justice and political freedom to those who live there. And that's not easily arrived at, and that will not be arrived at in our lifetime. And there will always be those who will preach to us about the obscene differential between what we have and what others have. And there will always be those who will use the excuse, well, if I gave everything that I had, I will have nothing, and they will still have very little, which will be quickly eaten up. In other words, there will always be the callous and the selfish, and there will always be the romantically compassionate. And someplace in between lies judgment, and someplace in between lies the standard of judgment. 40% of those who live in the third world are 14 years of age and below. Nearly 70% of those who live in the third world are 30 years of age or below. And I cite you these figures because for all of its breadth, and this document is full of ideas, many of them quite effective and quite persuasive, for all of this, this document suffers from the peculiar myopia of the Roman Catholic Church as to one of the great causes of poverty in the third world: overpopulation. The church in this area is not part of the solution. It's part of the problem. In the Philippines, in Kenya, in other places where the church is strong, the church hierarchy has fought government-sponsored birth control clinics and birth control programs. And yet, clearly, there will be no prosperity in the third world of any significant sense until the third world begins to be able to control this explosion of life, this flood of babies, which eats up the Green Revolution, for which it cannot provide adequate institutions for learning, which it simply cannot care. Cairo, in 1900, was a city of less than 1 million people. No one knows how many people are in Cairo today, but the estimates run between 12 million and 15 million. And the city of Cairo is growing by nearly 500,000 people a year. Now, whether we're talking about Cairo or Tehran or Madras or Bogota, the issue is the same: overpopulation, over-urbanization, the inability of these countries to deal with their problems, because whatever they do is always too little. It's always being submerged by this flood tide of humanity. And one of the paradoxes of the social thought of the Roman Catholic Church remains that despite this sense of urgency, this emphasis on justice, which we can only applaud in this document and in so many other of the speeches of the present Pope, it continues to take this archaic, medieval, and to my way of thinking, sinful position on the question of the quantity of human life as opposed to the quality of human life. The one biblical text that I wish it could read out of its theology is be fruitful, and multiply, and fill up the earth. The rabbis long ago defined be fruitful and multiply as having two children, son and a daughter. You didn't have to have 16 and 18 and 20 in order to prove your faith. This document, I think, comes at an opportune time because it engages on a very high ideological and intellectual level, concerns which every sensitive human being must feel about the nature of the American economy, about the future of our society, and about the future of our world. It comes at a time when clearly many of the proposals which are contained in this document are not going to be carried through. We're going to cut the social budget and not increase it, as this document demands. I cannot imagine that this administration, or any administration for that matter, which faces the challenges that to the economy that is that of our own nation, would carry out the massive expenditure of foreign aid which this document would seem to demand. We've all of us come to recognize that the prosperity of the economy as a whole ultimately affects the well-being of the whole. But we must never allow that truth to make us neglect what the bishops have not neglected: the individual, suffering human being, the persons who have not had a chance, the persons who are unemployed and underemployed and unemployable, the poor among us, and the poor who are not among us, who are out there in the larger world. The call which these bishops make is ultimately one to which we have to make some kind of meaningful response, whether we can agree with them in all of their perspectives is another matter. For the response must be made. A society which ultimately accepts the existence that the poor shall always be among you, to quote an earlier Christian text which the bishops have fortunately left behind them, society which accepts that kind of attitude becomes cold and compassionate and lacking in compassion and greedy, and ultimately those who have fall to fighting among each other for the scraps at the table. And so I welcome the bishops insofar as they've become Jewish. I wish they'd become a little more Jewish, but I empathize with them and share with them many of their concerns about our society today. Amen.